For seeing you, he says, he will rejoice in himself. Exod 4:14. As though the mere sight of the man of excellence were sufficient to fill the mind with gladness, unburdening it of the most hateful of the soul's evils, grief. But rejoicing is granted to no wicked person, just as is also sung in the words of the prophets. There is no rejoicing for the impious, says God, Isa 48:22. For this is truly a saying and a divine oracle, that the life of every worthless person is gloomy, grief-laden, and full of misery, even if it pretends to smile in its outward face. For I would not say that the Egyptians truly rejoiced, in truth, when they heard that Joseph's brothers had come, but rather that they feigned appearances by putting on a show. For no rebuke that comes upon fools is pleasant, just as no physician is pleasant to the undisciplined invalid. For toil follows what is beneficial, and ease follows what is harmful. And those who prefer ease to toil naturally come to hate those who recommend what is beneficial. So whenever you hear that Pharaoh and his court rejoiced, Gen 45:16, at the arrival of Joseph's brothers, do not suppose that this was true delight, unless perhaps insofar as they expected him to change from the goods of the soul, on which he had been raised, to the endless desires of the body, having falsified the ancient and ancestral coinage of his kindred virtue. Having conceived such hopes, the pleasure-loving mind does not consider it enough to hook the younger men, those only just beginning their training in self-control, with the bait of desires. It considers it a terrible thing unless it also brings under its sway the elder reason, in whom the raging passions have already grown old and subsided. For again, he speaks, offering losses as though they were benefits. Take your father and your possessions, and come to me, Ibid. 18 to Egypt and to this fearsome king, who drags back by force the goods that are our ancestral and truly existing possessions, once they have advanced outside the body, for by nature they are free, forcing them to be handed over to a most bitter prison, having appointed as jailer. So the oracle says, Potiphar the eunuch and chief cook, Gen 39. 1. A man deprived of noble things and cut off from the generative powers of the soul. And moreover, unable to sow or plant anything pertaining to education. A man who, in the manner of a cook, kills living things and cuts and divides them limb by limb and part by part, and wallows among lifeless and dead things, not so much bodies as affairs. And, by his elaborate seasonings, rouses and provokes the impulses of the endless passions, which it would have been fitting instead to tame and calm. And he says, I will give you all the good things of Egypt, and you shall eat the marrow of the land. Gen 45:18. But we shall say to him, we who have beheld the goods of the soul do not admit any good of the body. For the thrice longed for desire for those goods is sufficient, once it has melted within us, to work forgetfulness of everything dear to the flesh. Such, then, is the false-named joy of the foolish. But the true joy has already been spoken of, and it fits only the man of worth. So he fell down and laughed. Gen 17:17, falling not away from God, but away from himself. For he stood firm with respect to the unchangeable one, but fell from his own self-conceit. Such is the falsely named joy of the foolish, but the true joy has already been described, and it belongs to the good alone. So he fell down and laughed. Gen 17:17, not falling away from God, but from himself. For he stood firm with respect to the unchangeable one, but fell from his own self-conceit. And so, when the mind's presumption of wisdom had been cast down, and the God-loving disposition had been roused and set firmly upon the unswerving alone, he laughed, and at once, he said in his understanding, shall a child be born to a 100-year-old man, and shall Sarah, who is 90 years old, give birth? Ibid. Do not, however, think that the phrase, not with the mouth, but in the understanding, is added carelessly, but rather with great precision. Why? Because by saying, if a child will be born to the 100-year-old man, he seems to raise a doubt about the birth of Isaac, a birth which he was earlier said to have believed in, as this recent oracle made clear. This one shall not inherit you, but the one who shall come out of you, and immediately after he said, and Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him as righteousness. Gen 15:4-6. Since then it was not consistent for one who had believed to doubt, he made the doubt not long-lasting, not extending as far as the tongue and mouth, but stopping short within the swiftly moving understanding itself. For in the understanding, it says, he spoke. A thing which none of those praised for swiftness of foot could outrun, since it has outstripped even every winged creature. This, I think, is why the most esteemed of the Greek poets said, like a wing or a thought, showing the swiftness of quickness, later intensifying it by making thought swifter than the wing of an arrow. For the understanding travels over many things and bodies at once, in the same moment, with an unutterable motion, and reaches at once to the ends of earth and sea, contracting and cutting through the boundless distances. And at the very same time, it leaps up so far from the earth that it ascends through the air into the ether, and comes to rest, with difficulty, near the outermost vault of the fixed stars. For its fiery and burning heat does not allow it to remain at rest. Hence it goes far beyond, and is carried outside the boundary of this whole realm of sense perception, toward that which is fashioned, of kindred nature, out of the forms. So in the case of the good man, the turning aside was brief, indivisible, without parts, not perceptible by sense, but only by the understanding, in a certain way timeless. But perhaps someone might say, what then, that one who has believed admits even a trace or shadow or breath of unbelief at all? This person, I think, wishes to say nothing else than that he declares the one who has come into being to be uncreated, the mortal immortal, the perishable imperishable, and man, if it is right to say it, God. For the faith which falls to a human being's lot, he says, must be so secure as to differ in no way from that faith which concerns being itself, the faith that is complete and full in every respect. For Moses says in the greater song, God is faithful, and there is no injustice in him, Deut 32:4. But it is great ignorance to suppose that a human soul can contain the virtues of God, which are unswerving and utterly steadfast. It is enough to be able to acquire images of them, images diminished by many and great degrees from their archetypes, and perhaps not even that is unreasonable. For the virtues of God must necessarily be unmixed, since God too is not a composite, being a simple nature. But the virtues of human beings are mixed, since we too have come into being as mixtures, blended of the divine and the mortal, and harmonized according to the principles of perfect music. And whatever is composed of several elements has, by nature, opposing poles toward each of its parts. Happy is the one to whom it has been given to incline, for the greater part of his life, toward the better and more divine portion. For to do so for the whole of time is impossible, since the opposing weight of mortality sometimes tips the balance the other way, and lying in wait seizes its opportunity in the untimely lapses of reasoning, so as to resist by force. Abraham then believed God, Gen 15:6, but he believed as a man, so that you may know the peculiar mark of mortality and learn that no other turning could come upon him except one that arose from his own nature. But if the turning was brief and momentary, one ought to give thanks for it, for many others have been swept away entirely, submerged by the rush and current, and destroyed by its force. For virtue in a mortal body, noble friend, is not, according to most sacred Moses, sound of foot, but suffers something like numbness, limping a little. For the broad part of his thigh was numbed, it says, and because of it he limped. Gen 32:25-31. But perhaps one of the bolder sort might come forward and say that this utterance is not that of a man who disbelieves, but of one who is praying that if the best of the good emotions, joy, is to be born, it should be born by no other numbers than the 90 and the 100, Gen 17:17, so that the perfect good might come into being through perfect numbers. And the numbers mentioned are indeed perfect, especially according to the most sacred records. Let us look at each of them. Shem, at once the son of righteous Noah and ancestor of the seeing race, is said to have been 100 years old when he begot Arphaxad, Gen 11:10, whose name is interpreted, he threw wretchedness into confusion, a fine thing to shake, confound, and destroy the wretched offspring of the soul that is full of evils, namely injustice. But also Abraham plants a field, Gen 21:33, using the 100th measure to reckon out the plot of land, and Isaac finds barley yielding 100-fold, Gen 26:12. And Moses builds the court of the sacred tabernacle 100 cubits, Exod 27:9, measuring out the distance toward the east and the west. And the 100th part is a first fruit of the first fruits, which the Levites offer as first fruits to the priests, Num 18:28. For having received the tithes from the nation, they give to the priests, as from their own possessions, a sacred tenth of the tenths. One might, on further examination, find many other instances bearing on the honor of the number just mentioned in the laws, but for the present purpose, what has been said suffices. But if from the hundred you take away a sacred tenth as first fruit for God, who bears, increases, and fills the soul with fruits, you will leave another perfect number, the 90. For how is it not perfect, being the boundary between the first and the tenth, by which the Holy of Holies is set apart, in the manner of the middle curtain, Exod 26:33, by which things of the same kind are divided according to the distinctions found within their species. The good man then spoke to his understanding things that were truly good. But the base man sometimes expresses beautiful things most beautifully, yet does the most shameful things shamefully, just like Shechem, the offspring of folly, for his father is Hamor, which when translated means donkey, while Shechem itself, when interpreted, means shoulder, a symbol of toil. And wretched and full of misery is the toil that folly begets, just as beneficial is the toil to which quickness of mind is akin. At any rate, the oracles say that Shechem spoke to the understanding of the virgin, after first humbling her, Gen 34, 2-3. Was it not said with precision, he spoke to the understanding of the virgin, almost as if to show that he had done the very opposite of what he said? For Dinah is undeceived judgment, justice enthroned beside God, ever virgin, for both judgment and justice are translations of the name Dinah. This virgin the foolish attempt to corrupt through their daily counsels and practices, and by the fine appearance of their speech they escape refutation. They ought then, either to act in accordance with what they say, or, while doing wrong, to keep silent. For silence, they say, is half of an evil, just as Moses too, rebuking the one who claimed the birthright of primacy, but yielded second place to the imperishable God, says, "You have sinned, be silent." Gen 4:7. For to boast loudly of one's evils is a double sin. And this is more or less what happens to most people. They always speak of what is dear and just to the ever-virgin virtue, but they let slip no occasion on which, having the power, they will not outrage and mistreat her. For what city is not full of those who sing hymns to the ever-virgin virtue? They wear out the ears of everyone they meet, rehearsing such things as, "Prudence is necessary, folly is harmful. Self-control is to be chosen, licentiousness is hateful. Courage deserves to be endured for, cowardice to be fled. Justice is advantageous, injustice disadvantageous. The holy is noble, the unholy shameful. Reverence toward God is praiseworthy, irreverence blameworthy. It is most proper to human nature to deliberate, act, and speak well, and most foreign to it to do each of these badly." Repeating these and similar things endlessly, they deceive the law courts, the councils, the theaters, and every assembly and gathering of human beings, just like those who fit beautiful masks over the ugliest of faces, taking care not to be exposed by those who look on. But it is of no use, for some will come, thoroughly vigorous and possessed by zeal for virtue, who will strip away these coverings and amulets, all that they have woven together through their evil artistry of words, and will gaze upon the soul itself, naked and alone, and will come to know the secrets of its nature stored away in its inmost recesses. Then, bringing them out into the open, they will display to everyone, in the clear light of the sun, all its shame and disgrace, what sort of thing it really is, how shameful and ridiculous, and what a counterfeit beauty it had put on through its borrowed ornaments. Those ready to take vengeance on such profane and impure ways are two in number, Simeon and Levi, but one in purpose. Hence too, in the blessings, their father numbered them as one, Gen 49:5, because of the harmony of their conquered and their impulse toward one and the same object. But Moses no longer even mentions a pair, but has engraved the whole of Simeon into Levi, Deut 33:8, blending two substances into one, forming out of them a single thing, stamped as it were with one form, uniting hearing with action. Since then, the man of worth recognized that the promise, according to his own understanding, spoke of things full of reverence and caution, he experienced both feelings at once, faith toward God and distrust toward what is created. Fittingly, then, he says in his petition, "Let this Ishmael live before you," Gen 17:18. Placing each of the words he uses not at random, this, "let him live, before you." For many have been deceived by the ambiguity of names as applied to things. We must consider what I mean. Ishmael, when interpreted, means hearing of God, and of those who hear the divine teachings, some hear to their benefit, others to their own harm and that of others. Or do you not see the augur Balaam? He is introduced as one, hearing the sayings of God and possessing knowledge from the Most High, Num 24:16. But what did he gain from such hearing? What from such knowledge, he who set out, by deliberate choice, to maim the best eye of the soul, the eye trained to see God alone, yet was unable to do so because of the Savior's unconquerable power. And so he, pierced through by his own derangement of mind, received many wounds and perished among the wounded, Num 31:8, because he had counterfeited God-inspired prophecy with the sophistry of divination. Rightly, then, does the man of worth pray that this Ishmael alone may be healthy, on account of those who do not listen genuinely to the sacred teachings, men whom Moses expressly forbade to attend the assembly of the All-Ruler. For those whose generative faculty of thought has been crushed or wholly cut off, those who exalt their own mind and sense perception as the sole causes of human affairs, or the lovers of polytheism who have held in honor the many-godded throng, born of a harlot, not knowing the one man and father of the virtue-loving soul, God, are they not rightly driven out and banished? Deut 23, 1-2. Something similar, it seems to me, is done by parents who accuse their son of drunkenness, for they say, "This our son is disobedient." Deut 21:20, signifying by the addition of the word "this" that there are other children, steadfast and self-controlled, who obey the commands of right reason and instruction. For these are the soul's truest parents, by whom to be accused is most shameful, and to be praised most glorious. As for the words, "This is that Aaron and Moses, to whom God said, 'Lead out the sons of Israel from Egypt,'" Exod 6:26, "and these are they who spoke to Pharaoh the king," Ibid 27, let us not suppose these were said carelessly, or that the pointing out signifies nothing more than the bare names. For since Moses is the purest mind, and Aaron his reasoned speech, and the mind has been trained to think in a manner befitting God, and speech too to interpret holy things in a holy way, the sophists, mimicking them and counterfeiting this approved coinage, claim that they too think rightly about the best things and speak in a praiseworthy manner, Exod 7:11. So that we might not be deceived by setting the counterfeit beside the genuine because of a similarity in stamp, God gave a test by which the two would be distinguished. What then is the test? To lead the mind that is capable of vision, that loves the sight of God and loves wisdom, out of the region of the body. The one who is able to do this is the true Moses. The one who is unable, who is called by the name only while wrapped in countless empty titles, is an object of ridicule. As for Ishmael, he prays that he may live, not out of concern for the life joined to the body, but so that the divine hearing may be roused and kindled anew, everlasting upon the soul. The one, then, prays to live as a hearing of words and a learning of sacred teachings, as has been said. But Jacob, the man of practice, prays for good natural endowment. For he says, "Let Reuben live and not die," Deut 33:6. Is he then praying for immortality and incorruption, a thing impossible for a human being? Surely not. What then he wishes to convey must be explained. All that is heard and all that is learned is built up as upon a foundation already laid, a nature receptive of instruction. But where nature does not first exist, everything is useless. For those without natural aptitude seem to differ not at all from an oak or a deaf stone. Nothing adheres and fits itself to them, but everything rebounds and leaps away as from something hard and unyielding. But the souls of those well endowed by nature may be seen to resemble smoothed wax, blended in due measure, neither too hard nor too soft, readily receiving all that is heard and seen, and taking the perfect impress of their forms, vivid images stored in memory. It was necessary, then, for the rational race to pray that this good natural endowment be free from sickness and immortal. For few share in the life lived according to virtue, which is the only truly unerring life. I do not mean the common herd, for none of these has any part in true life, but only those, if any, who have managed to flee the pursuits of ordinary people and to live for God alone. For this reason, the ascetic and courageous one greatly marveled that anyone, carried along in the midst of life's river, is swept away by no current, and is able to withstand even great flowing wealth, to push back the onrush of unmeasured pleasure, and not be snatched up by the stormwind of empty glory. It is not Jacob, in fact, but rather the sacred word that says to Joseph, to every soul that is well-conditioned in body and finds itself examined amid an abundance of resources for wealth, and is captured by none of these, for you are still living. Gen 46:30, uttering a marvelous saying that outstrips our own life. For we, having caught a small breeze of good fortune, shake out every sail, and puffing ourselves up grandly, blow hard and steadily, run full-sailed toward the enjoyment of the passions, and do not furl our unrestrained, slackened desires until we run aground and wreck the whole vessel of the soul. Most beautifully, then, does he pray that this Ishmael may live. He adds, therefore, let him live before God. Gen 17:18, setting as the goal of happiness that the mind be deemed worthy of the oversight and watchful care of the best of beings. For if, when a tutor is present, the one led astray would not err. If a guide, being near, benefits the one learning. If a young man, in the presence of an elder, is adorned with reverence and self-control. And if a father or mother, merely by appearing at the right moment, restrains a son who is about to do wrong, to what surpassing degree of blessing do we suppose one attains who always believes himself to be watched by God? For the one who fears and trembles at the dignity of the one present and looking on will flee wrongdoing with all his might. When he prays that Ishmael may live, he has not, as I said before, despaired of the birth of Isaac, but he has put his trust in God. For it is not possible for a human being to receive the very things it is possible to give to God, since it is easy for God to grant the most and the greatest gifts, but it is not easy for us to receive the gifts held out to us. For it would be enough for us if we could obtain those good things that are companions of toil and practice, more familiar to us. But of those that come about of themselves, without art or any human contrivance at all, and arise ready-made, there is not even hope of attaining them. For these, being divine, must of necessity be found among natures more divine and undefiled, nature set free from the mortal body. Moses taught that thanksgiving should be made according to the power of one's hands, Num 6:21. The quick-witted dedicating as an offering his intelligence and prudence. The eloquent consecrating all the virtues found in speech, through both song and prose hymns to the existing one, and each according to his kind, the natural philosopher offering the study of nature, the moralist all of moral philosophy, the craftsman and man of science the principles of the arts and sciences. So too the sailor and the pilot will dedicate a safe voyage, the farmer a rich harvest of crops, the herdsman good breeding among his animals, the physician the health of the sick, the general in war his victory in battle, and the statesman or king his lawful governance and leadership. And, to sum it all up, whatever good things belong to soul, body, or external circumstances, the one who is not self-loving will declare God, the only truly unerring cause, to be their author. Let none of those who seem more obscure and lowly shrink, out of despair of the better hope, from becoming a grateful suppliant of God. But even if he expects nothing of the greater gifts, let him give thanks according to his own power for those things which he has already obtained. And he has obtained countless things: being, life, nourishment, soul, sense perception, imagination, impulse, reasoning. Reasoning is a small word, but a most perfect and most divine work, a fragment torn from the soul of the universe. Or, to speak more reverently, as those who philosophize according to Moses would say, an impression closely resembling a divine image. Worthy of praise, too, are those among the spies who attempted to uproot the entire trunk of virtue, root and all, and carry it off. But since they were unable, at least took a single branch with one cluster of grapes, a sample and portion of the whole, which alone they had strength to carry, Num 13:24. It is a thing to be prayed for, to dance in company with the whole massed throng of the virtues. But if this is too great for human nature, let us be content if it is granted to someone to encounter even one of them individually, self-control, or courage, or justice, or love of humanity. For let the soul bear and bring forth some one good thing, and not become altogether barren and without fruit. But you will lay such commands on your own son. If you are not gentle with your servants, nor sociable with your equals, if you are not decorous with your wife, nor respectful toward your parents, if you have contempt for your mother and father, you are impious toward the divine as well. If you delight in pleasure, do not abstain from love of money either. Give yourself over to desire and be vain as well. For why not? Do you think it right not to be moderate in some things, if you cannot be so in all? Would not a son then say, "What are you saying, father?" Do you want your son to be either perfectly good or perfectly bad? And will you not love him if, instead of the extremes, he chooses the middle course? Is this not why Abraham too, in the matter of the destruction of the Sodomites, beginning from the number 50, ends at 10 Gen 18 24, 32, imploring and beseeching, so that, if the complete release into freedom should not be found within that generation, of which the sacred 50th reckoning is the symbol, Lev 25:10. The middle education, reckoned alongside the number 10, might be accepted on behalf of the soul that is about to be condemned, toward its release. Among the unrefined, those who are educated, and among the unmusical and untrained in the arts, those who have taken part in the general round of culture, have more resources for growth, since from childhood they have been steeped in discourses about endurance and self-mastery and virtue of every kind. Hence, even if they have not entirely wiped and washed themselves clean, priding themselves on their brightness, still they have been cleansed moderately and to a middling degree. Something similar Esau seems to say to his father, "Have you only one blessing, father? Bless me also, father." Gen 27:38. For different blessings have been allotted to different people, perfect ones to the perfect, middling ones to the imperfect, just as it is with bodies too. For the healthy and the sick have different exercises and different foods, and other matters of regimen are not the same for both. Rather, one diet suits the one group, so that they may not fall ill at all, and another suits the other, so that they may change toward better health. Since there are many good things existing in nature, grant me whichever of them seems to fit me, even if it is the very smallest, taking aim at this alone, whether I shall be able to bear easily what is given, and not, failing at even this, collapse in my misfortune. What do we suppose is signified by the words, "Is the hand of the Lord not sufficient?" Num 11:23. Is it not that the powers of the existing one reach in every direction to do good, not only to those held in honor, but also to those who seem more obscure? To these he grants what is fitting, weighing and measuring, in equal proportion within himself, what is appropriate to each according to the weights and measures of each individual soul. I am struck no less by the law laid down concerning those who strip off their sins and seem to repent. For it commands that the first offering brought should be an unblemished ewe. But if, it says, his hand is not sufficient for a sheep, he shall bring, for the sin he has sinned, two turtle doves or two young pigeons, one for a sin offering and one for a whole burnt offering. And if his hand cannot find a pair of turtle doves or two young pigeons, he shall bring as his gift a tenth of an ephah of fine flour. He shall not pour oil on it, nor put frankincense on it, because it is for sin. And he shall bring it to the priest, and the priest shall take a full handful of it as a memorial portion and place it on the altar. Lev 5, 7, 11, 12. So then, by these three means it propitiates repentance, by cattle or by birds or by fine white wheat, according to the capacity of the one being purified and presumably repenting. For small offerings are not required of the great, nor great offerings of the small, but offerings equal and similar in proportion. It is worth inquiring, then, why purification is by three means. It happens that sins and right actions alike are, roughly speaking, examined under three heads: thought, speech, and deed. For this reason, in his exhortations, Moses, teaching that the acquisition of the good is neither impossible nor hard to attain, says, "You need not fly up to heaven, nor go to the ends of earth and sea, to grasp it. Rather, it is near, very near." Then he shows it almost visibly. "Every deed is in your mouth and in your heart and in your hands," Deut 30, 12-14, meaning symbolically, in words, in counsels, in works. For human happiness is constituted from good counsel, good speech, and good action, just as unhappiness is constituted from their opposites. For right action and sin occur in the very same regions, heart, mouth, and hand. Indeed, some people deliberate with the utmost good sense, speak excellently, and do what ought to be done. Of the three, the lightest fault is to deliberate about what one should not. The heaviest is to carry out with the hand what is unfitting, and the middle is to say what one ought not. Yet it turns out that the lightest is hardest to shake off. For it is difficult to bring the soul's turning to rest, and one could more quickly check the rush of a torrent than the soul's turning as it flows uncontrollably. For countless thoughts, one upon another, sweep over it like breakers, carrying it, churning it, and violently overturning the whole of it. The best and most complete form of purification, then, is this: not even to entertain in thought anything improper, but to conduct one's civic life in peace and good order, whose leader is justice. The second is not to go wrong in speech, by lying, swearing falsely, deceiving, sophistry, false accusation, or in general by letting loose mouth and tongue for the destruction of others, faults on which it would have been better to fasten a bridle and an unbreakable bond. Why speaking what is unfitting is a heavier sin than merely thinking it is easier to see. Sometimes a person entertains a thought not by his own will, but because he is unwilling. For he is compelled to receive notions he does not wish to take in, and nothing involuntary is culpable. But one speaks willingly, so that if he does not utter a fitting word, he does wrong out of sheer folly. He who is unwilling to say anything more decent even by chance, when it would have profited him to embrace the safest course, silence, and moreover, one who is not keeping quiet could surely, had he wished, hold his tongue. But a heavier sin than speaking is an unjust deed. For, as they say, word is the shadow of deed. And if the shadow does harm, how is the deed not more harmful still? For this reason, Moses exempted mere intention from charges and penalties, since it is subject for the most part to involuntary changes and turnings, and is acted upon by thoughts that come in from outside rather than acting itself. But whatever proceeds out through the mouth, he brings to account and to reckoning, on the ground that speaking is within our own power. But the reckonings for words are more measured, while those for culpable deeds are harsher. For he sets great punishments on those who do great wrong and carry into action, by deed, what they had planned with an unjust mind and blurted out with a rash tongue. The means of purification for the three, thought, speech, and deed, he has stated: a sheep and a pair of turtle doves or pigeons and a tenth measure of sacred fine flour, requiring that thought be purified by the sheep, speech by the birds, and deed by the fine flour. Why? Because just as mind is the best thing in us, so too among the irrational animals the sheep is best, being the gentlest of creatures and producing yearly of itself a crop for the benefit and adornment of humankind alike. For its fleece wards off harm from cold and heat, and veiling what nature keeps hidden, serves the decorum of those who wear it. Let the best of animals, the sheep, then be a symbol of the purification of the best thing, thought, and let the winged creatures be a symbol of speech. For speech too is light and winged by nature, born faster than an arrow, darting everywhere. For what has once been said cannot be recalled, but once carried out, running with great speed, it strikes the ears and, passing through the whole of hearing, sounds at once. Speech is twofold, one kind true, the other false. For the sake of this, I think, it has been likened to a pair of turtle doves or pigeons. Of the two birds, he says one must be for sin and the other offered as a whole burnt offering, since the true word turns out to be holy and entirely sacred and perfect, while the false word has gone astray and needs correction. The symbol of deed, as I said, is the fine flour. For this too happens to be refined not without skill and forethought, but is sifted by the hands of bakers, men who have made the task their profession. Hence he also says, the priest, taking a full handful, shall offer up its memorial portion, Lev 5:12, signifying by the handful the undertaking and the doing. With great precision he said of the beast of the flock, if his hand is not sufficient for a sheep, Lev 5:7, but of the birds, if he cannot find, Lev 5:11. Why? Because it takes great strength and surpassing power to overcome the soul's turnings of thought, but not great might to check the sins of speech. For silence, as I said before, is the remedy for every fault committed through speech, and it is easy for anyone to make use of. But many people, because of their talkativeness and lack of measure in words, cannot find a way to put a limit on their speech. Having been nurtured and trained in these and similar distinctions and divisions of things, would it not seem reasonable for the man of worth to pray that Ishmael might live, since he is not yet able to conceive Isaac? What then does the good God do? To one who asks for one thing he gives two, and to one who prays for the lesser he grants the greater. For it says, God said to Abraham, yes, behold, Sarah your wife shall bear you a son, Gen 17:19. The symbolic answer, yes, hits the mark precisely. For what is more fitting than that God should not assent to good things and confess them readily, but every fool shakes his head in refusal at the things to which the divine nods assent. At any rate, the oracles introduce Li as hated, and that is why she received such a name, for when interpreted, it means one who refuses and one who grows weary, because all of us turn away from virtue and consider its commands wearisome, since they often enjoin things that are not pleasant. Yet she has been judged worthy of such acceptance by the ruler of all that her womb, opened by him, Gen 29:31, received the sowing of divine seed for the begetting of noble pursuits and actions. Learn then, O soul, that not only Hagar, the intermediate education, but also Sarah, virtue, shall bear you a son. For her offspring is taught, but the offspring of Sarah is altogether self-taught. Do not be surprised if God, who brings forth all things that are excellent, has brought forth this kind too rare on earth, but very abundant in heaven. You may learn this from the other faculties of which man is composed. Do the eyes see because they have been taught? Do the nostrils smell by instruction? Do the hands touch, or the feet go forward, at the commands or exhortations of teachers? And the impulses and impressions, these being the first motions and states of the soul, did they come to be by teaching? Did our mind, by attending some sophist school, learn to think and comprehend? All these things, released from teaching, employ a self-acting nature for their own proper activities. Why then do you still marvel, if God will also rain down virtue that is free of toil and hardship, needing no oversight, but from the beginning whole and complete? And if you want a testimony more trustworthy still, you will find that of Moses, who says that for other men food comes from the earth, but for the man of vision alone, from heaven. Now with the foods that come from the earth, human farmers also cooperate, but the foods from heaven, the one self-working God rains down without the collaboration of others. And indeed it is said, "Behold, I rain bread upon you from heaven," Exod 16:4. What food, then, does he rightly say is rained down from heaven, if not heavenly wisdom? This wisdom from above, he who possesses abundance and prosperity of understanding sends down upon souls that have a longing for virtue, watering all things, and especially on the sacred seventh day, which he calls the Sabbath, Exod 16:23 FF. For then, he says, there will be a bringing forth of good things that come of themselves, not sprouting from any deliberate craft, but budding by a self-generated and self-completing nature, and bearing their own proper fruits. So then virtue will bear you a noble male son, Gen 17:19, freed from every feminine passion, and you shall call the name of the son by the name of the feeling you will feel over him, and you will altogether feel joy. So that you will also give it a name symbolic of that feeling, laughter. Just as pain and fear have utterances tinged with venom, which the passion that has done violence and gained the mastery gives a name to, so good counsel and gladness compel the use of natural exclamations, than which one could not find names more proper or more exactly aimed, even if one happened to be wise about names. That is why it says, "I have blessed him, I will increase him, I will multiply him, he shall father 12 nations." Gen 17:20, the whole circle and chorus of the sophistic preliminary studies, "But my covenant I will establish with Isaac." Gen 17:21, so that the race of men might have a share of each virtue, the taught and the self-taught, the weaker being taught, the vigorous being ready-made. At this season, he says, wisdom shall bear you joy, Gen 17:21. What season, most amazing one, are you pointing to? Is it not the one alone that is undisclosed by any process of becoming? For the true season itself would be the well-doing and the good timing of all things of earth, of heaven, of the natures in between, of living beings and plants alike. That is why Moses too had the courage to say to those who fled and were unwilling to take up the war for virtue against those arrayed against them, "Their season has departed from them, but the Lord is among us," Num 14:9. For he all but openly confesses that God is the season, he who stands far off from every impious person, but walks about among souls that are becoming virtuous. For he says, "I will walk about among you, and I will be your God." Lev 26:12. Those who say that the seasons of the year are the seasons are misusing the word improperly, since they have not at all precisely grasped the natures of things, but partake largely of the arbitrary. Heightening the beauty of the one to be born, he says he will be born in the other year. Gen 17:21, meaning by other year, not the interval of time that is measured by the cycles of the moon, but that which is truly displaced, strange, and new other than the things seen and perceived by sense, examined among things bodiless and intelligible, which held the pattern and archetype of time, namely eternity. And eternity is recorded as the life of the intelligible cosmos, just as time is the life of the perceptible one. In which year he also finds barley yielding 100-fold. Gen 26:12, he who has sown God's graces for the begetting of a greater number of good things, so that as many as possible of those worthy might come to share in them. But indeed it is customary for the one who has sown also to reap. Yet he is said to have sown, displaying the virtue that is hostile to envy and evil, and to have found, but not to have reaped. For it was another who had made the ear of grain of his benefactions fuller and more abundant, one who, having prepared and made ready greater hopes and more numerous gifts, set them before those who sought to find them. The phrase he finished speaking with him, Gen 17:22, is equivalent to saying that he brought the hearer himself to completion, who before was empty of wisdom, and filled him with immortal words. And when the disciple had become complete, the Lord went up from Abraham, Ibid, showing not that he was separated from him, for by nature the wise man is God's attendant, but wishing to establish the voluntary character of the disciple, so that what he had learned he might now display of himself, without the teacher any longer standing over him, not by compulsion, but employing a willing and self-commanded eagerness, and so act through himself. For the teacher gives to the one who has learned room for voluntary practice without prompting, engraving thereby the surest form of unforgettable memory.